and you can make a fortune in the minors. Same thing happened in the 2000s. We had the dot-com bubble pop, and then we had 9/11, and then we had the great financial crisis. So both of those decades, we had economic turmoil. Well, we haven't had economic turmoil. Last decade, there isn't any economic turmoil, and we haven't had any yet this decade. So we're...
Don DeRemmett, Gold Stock Data, how are you, my friend?
Hey, Andy, it's good to be back on your show.
It's great to have you, my friend. Let's start with really just since January, we have been ripping here on the stocks as well as the physical metals, gold and silver. Give me your thoughts on that. Why are we ripping? Why are we ripping in the miners and what's on the horizon?
Well, basically all about Trump and bullishness around Trump. So we came into the year and you had these tailwind with Trump winning in November, and everybody's thinking that Trump's going to help the economy, and the S&P and gold have been trading together. Nothing's been able to push gold down. And I don't think anything will be able to, but you've had a lot of bullishness. We had an all-time high in February with the stock market, 6180. Gold kind of followed it up, and gold just ripped. It got to 3,000. And a lot of it, like I said, gold trading with the S&P, but that's a misnomer, really. We'll talk about really what's driving gold. But we look at kind of what's happened here with the S&P. The S&P is rolled over. We had a 5% correction down to 55.35, something on there. And now I said this is just a dead cat bounce. I thought we'd maybe get to 5,800, and we're at 57.62. So this week, I think we'll get to 5,800. I don't think we'll get to 59. And then nobody seems to be taking Trump seriously on his tariffs. It's like the market bounced today because Trump is basically backed off on his reciprocal. They said it's going to be more targeted. So we got a little bit of bounce here up 1.5% on the S&P today because people are saying, well, it's not going to be across the board. If it was across the board, I mean, we would have probably crashed immediately. But even targeted, Trump is not going to back off from these tariffs. He said in the State of the Union, he said two things in the State of the Union I thought was really interesting. One, he said he's going to balance the budget. Well, the only way he's not going to raise taxes. There's no way. So the only way he's going to get that kind of balance the budget, he's going to need a lot of money, tariff money. So the fact that he said he was going to balance the budget, he needs revenue from tariffs. So he's not going to back down on tariffs. Tariffs are coming in a big way. Then he said that, in the same speech, he said that we're going to use tariffs to liberate on the American soul. To save America's soul. Tariffs were going to save America's soul. And that's a serious comment. Then he said last week that it was going to be Liberation Day, April 2nd. So my bottom line is that tariffs are coming. He's not going to back down on this. And the other point is he's not using tariffs for negotiation. He's not trying to create the status quo. He's not trying to create a better globalism. He's not trying to do that. He's not trying to say, okay, we're going to put in better free trade across the world because we have low tariffs. So everybody's going to have low tariffs. We're going back to globalism. That's not what Trump's trying to do here. He's trying to basically reverse globalism. Well, this was 50 years in the making. Basically, in early 1970s, the U.S., we stopped dominating the world. We were a mercantilistic economy from 45 to 70, and we lost that, and everything started flipping in the 70s. Now Trump has basically realized that we can't do this anymore. So he came into office, we had a $2 trillion deficit. We had a $1.1 trillion deficit in the first 5 months of this fiscal year, which starts in October. 1.1. So we got a $2 trillion deficit. I don't care what Doge cuts this year. I mean, he's already at 1.1. Good luck. You know, he's behind the eight ball already. So, and interest expense is over $1 trillion. It's like the thing is that Trump was handed such a bad hand. So Wall Street is ignoring two things. They're ignoring the fact that Trump is serious about tariffs, and they're gonna hurt the economy. They're missing that. They just think he's gonna back down. It's a negotiation. They're missing the whole thing. Number two is what Trump. It's really difficult to hold the ball underwater, and that's kind of what they gave Trump. They gave Trump an economy that's slowing. I tweeted today, the Atlanta GDP now has first quarter, their last data point was March 18th, is -1.8%. And we only have a week left in this quarter. And so, Wow. And so Trump's trying to keep the economy growing when it's slowing.
Yeah.
And to fix this debt problem. He's trying to thread a needle that's impossible. And so my point is that I think the recession is started in this quarter, and the tariffs are just going to make it worse. It's a trigger, and that this is a dead cat bounce in the S&P 500. And next month in April, we're going to have the second shoe to drop. And I think we're going to go down to 5,300 in the S&P. And then it's just going to bleed from there. And it's like, I think this is the end of era for America. I really do, because Trump's playing with fire. We haven't had a recession in 15 years. And anybody that thinks that we're going to go into recession and the Fed's going to basically save us, the Fed doesn't have the tools to save us. They can't cut rates quickly and aggressively, because that'll cause too much inflation. And they can't print money at a huge level, what would be needed to restart the economy. So it's a train wreck in every direction you look in.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot there. Let me ask you some specifics then. The Fed is in the box, and I would agree 100% with you. But what is the, do you think they won't cut, or are they going to be forced to cut?
Yeah, I think they're going to be forced to cut. I've always said that the Fed, their number one priority is not inflation. Their number one priority is to prevent an economic meltdown, which they've been doing since 2008. They say that the Fed has a dual mandate of low inflation and full employment. And I basically say that changed in 2008. They have a new mandate that overrides those two. And the new mandate is to keep the economy growing, to not let it melt down. In other words, manipulate the hell out of this thing so it doesn't fall on its face. I think that's their number one mandate. So they don't care about inflation. That's not their number one mandate. So if the stock market crashes, they'll cut immediately. They'll say, we don't care about inflation. We care about this economy. That's more important, because if this thing it melts down, nobody has a job. It's better to have inflation and a job than no job and inflation, right? So they will cut. By the end of the year, I'm expecting the Fed funds rate to be 3% or lower. They're going to cut significantly, 2.5 to 3%, but it'll be hard for them to get it below 2.5. They're not going to be able to take it back to zero. That's the past. That's not happening.
Okay. So that's some severe implications here. I would say my first bond market, and I want, in just a minute, I want you to comment about that. But in the near term, this is all rolling over next month. Your thesis is rolling over next month in April. What exactly does that look like? You think we had a dead cat bounce here in the S&P? You think the S&P is going to significantly come down more next month? Correct me if I'm wrong. And it looks like that the metals have sniffed this out. Correct me if I'm wrong, because you have gold very firm. Silver's actually above 33 here, way above 30. And yet the S&P is, despite the dead cat bounce, it's broken away. There's a dichotomy now between the metals and the S&P. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do you see that continuing?
Okay, so earlier I mentioned that we're going to talk about what's pushing gold higher. I basically said it was following the S&P. I firmly believe that what gold is sniffing out is this idea that I think is happening, which is a transition a kind of a Bretton Woods transition point where the U.S. Is losing its footing, if you will, and nobody knows what when it loses its footing, exactly what that's going to entail. When I say losing its footing, I'm talking about what we've had in place since 1945, which is basically the U.S. dominating the U.S. currency, the U.S. dollar dominating trade, and that's slowly whittling away. And in tandem with that is the U.S. basically dominating global trade agreements, like the BRICS, the Global South. We're seeing these big shifts. And if the U.S. goes into a recession, so the U.S. hasn't had a recession in 15 years. If the U.S. goes into recession, what happens? Remember, the financial system almost burned to the ground in 2007-08. And people still remember that. I mean, it could happen again. And then the big elephant in the room, and I really think this is why gold keeps going higher and higher, is the U.S. bond market is becoming fragile. The U.S. bonds have always been considered zero risk, and that's changing. If the bonds are no longer risk free, and dollars become a hot potato that people are basically saying, I don't want these reserves, get rid of them. And most reserves are held in bonds. Like, I don't want these dollar reserves anymore. I want to trade in something else. It's a paradigm shift. And I think that's what's driving gold more than anything else. And then when you throw on top of that Basel III, then you really put this floor underneath gold. Basel III makes gold a tier one asset for the first time. So that means banks can put gold on their balance sheet and loan against it. And they can use it as liquidity in their bank. They can use it assets on their balance sheet.
Yeah.
So gold is the equivalent of a bond, a U.S. Treasury bond. And so that combination is pushing gold higher. And that's why I think $2,700 is the floor here for gold because of everything I just mentioned.
Yeah. So to all my listeners and viewers here, I was laughing off camera. Not that I disagree with you, Don. I actually 100% agree with you, but it's like, if you just start thinking about it, it's like, here we are. It's just mind blowing, really.
Worse than that, Andy. I got to cut you off there. It's worse than that.
Yeah.
People don't realize what's coming. And it's about ready to start. The shoe's about ready to drop here. And we've had clues. We've had hints of this. It kind of started in 2016 when Trump was elected and the mainstream media in America just stopped doing their job. They quit. They basically said, screw it. We don't care about the truth. They stopped. And Trump basically said, you're fake news. Right? I mean, it all started right then. And it was like, I mean, you can't believe a word you hear now on mainstream media. They literally stopped doing their job. I mean, yeah. I read Time Magazine just to get an idea of what the mainstream's up to. And they literally have these important articles written, like about Trump, written by somebody that's woke. It's like, what the heck am I reading here? This is a political analyst? I mean, it's off the charts. It's off the charts insanity, what we're seeing. Everybody has seen this. Everybody has seen this insanity, right? Mm-hmm. Clear as day. We've seen it. I mean, look at the way they went after Trump in these politically motivated trials. It was obvious it was politically motivated. Look what the FBI did January 6th. They put these guys in jail for trespassing for 4 years they just walked in. I mean, they just walked in. It was trespassing, literally. Put them in jail for 4 years for trespassing? I mean, it's just insanity. We've seen it. My point is that these are clues of what's coming. So the first thing we did, we lost our media. I mean, it's gone. It's not coming back. The second thing that happened was our political system broke. And that started breaking in the early 1990s with Newt Gingrich when he created the Contract for America. When he did that, he basically split America in half and said, here's the Contract with America. Well, guess what? Not all of America agreed with it. It was basically a chasm. He just basically split America in half with that Contract America. We've never gone back. It just kept getting wider and wider and wider and wider. And it got to the point which we have today, where we do not, our Republicans and Democrats do not see eye to eye anymore. Our values are gone. The American values have been ripped to shreds, and they're not, and it's not coming back. So where I'm going with this, it's not just an economic problem. The economic problem is the final chapter here. When the economy goes south and everything starts breaking down and the bond market cannot bail out everybody like they did in 2008, at that point, the political chasm shows its face. And now you have no solutions. Because if you don't have any political agreement, you can't fix a problem. And so that's what's going to happen. And so it's basically a spiral downward effect. This is the same thing that happened to Japan in the 80s with their economy, but their culture held them together. But what happened there is it's history rhyming. So you had all this foreign money going to the Japanese stock market in the 80s, and it ripped all the way to 47,000, and then crashed all the way down. All the foreign money went home. Well, now today we have anywhere from 18 to 25% of our stock market is foreign money. Well, we have $50 trillion in there. So if we take 20%, let's just go a little, because I've seen two estimates, 118, 125. So if we just use the low estimate of 20%, that's $10 trillion of foreign money in our stock market. It's already starting to move away back to Europe. Well, that we're going to see trillions of dollars, 10 trillion. We're seeing trillions of dollars come out of our stock market. And guess what? It's not coming back. So once the stock market in April, I think we're going to go below 5,300. And a lot of that's going to be foreign money, but a lot of it's going to be American money too. But then once we get below 5,000, people are like, foreign money's like, when it comes out, it's not coming back. And that's the same thing that happened to Japan. And guess what? Japan's stock market, once it crashed, it never came back. I mean, decades, right? And that's what's going to happen to us. Yeah. But the problem is our economy is overlevered. And so when it does crash, it's like kind of burn to the ground type of situation. But technology will keep it afloat, and you'll have winners and losers. So you're going to have high unemployment. I think we'll go above 10%. That's what will be official numbers, but then unofficial will be about 20, high teens, right?
Wow.
If you have a job, it'll be okay. But the problem is this is going to last years. Once we start going over the cliff kind of thing, it's going to be, we're not going to put this genie back in the bottle at all. It's literally the end of America, the end of an era. Where we're heading is America's going to go bye-bye. What's going to replace it is a series of regions, basically the same thing as the EU. Where you have France and Germany and Belgium and Spain, we're going to have regions, but we're not going to have an EU. You know, they have a centralized government. We're not going to have an EU. We're just going to be separate regions. We create our own laws and go our own way. And so that's going to be a theme that begins in a couple of years, this go your own way. That's how these regions create. So once you start going your own way, you start ignoring Washington. Mm-hmm. We'll have these areas that just ignore Washington and just create their own little laws. You know, I don't know how it's going to unfold, but towards the end of this decade, we'll have this go your own way. And then eventually Washington will become irrelevant and we'll just ignore it. And Washington will just go bye-bye. And then America's gone. I mean, it's a very sad situation. I'm not happy about it at all. Our standard of living is going to go in the toilet. It's not going to come back. We're going to lose our standard of living, which I'm not happy about at all. But the one thing that we're going to get, which is good going forward. I write about this in my book called The Path Forward, by the way. The one thing that we have that we're going to get the benefit of all that is the American values of freedom are going to come back in a big way.
Yeah.
If you want to live in a free country, America is going to be the place to be. So there's going to be regions that are very focused on freedom, and that's where people are going to want to live. So kind of the blue states and the red states kind of create their own areas, right? The left coast and the right coast, west coast and the east coast is probably where you don't want to live, you know, if you're libertarian, conservative, right? And then, you know, out in the West and the South and the Midwest, a little bit more in the South, more conservative, but very freedom-oriented, libertarian-oriented, which is very, I think, is going to be very positive. Because I think freedom is kind of our number one. I think that's why this country was built. And so we're not going to give away that foundation of freedom. It's not going bye-bye. But America's going bye-bye. And so that's no fun.
Yeah, it is sad. But yet I'm optimistic, and maybe not specifically for America, but I agree with you that pockets, maybe regions, I like that better. That's what's going to pop up in the U.S., if you would. And I'm just grateful that I live in a freedom region, if you like, a freedom living region. Let's talk about specifics. Well, we'll start in general now, and then we'll maybe can get into a little bit of specifics about the gold stock and the silver, well, the precious metal stock area here. We've again, they've been ripping here since the new year. I've been doing quite well. You've been, I'm sure, doing quite well. What exactly do you see that breaking apart from the S&P? And it seems like it certainly has. And do you see money flowing into the precious metal stocks as opposed to the S&P? Or do you see this as a sector? If you would, like, it just depends on what sector you're in to make any money, as well as do you see this as stock specific? You have to be in stock specific to make money.
No, you can be the whole sector, but let's talk about it. So for me, you only make a big alpha in gold and silver miners during a significant upcycle era period. So we've had two of those since 1970. You had the 1970s, which was an era of economic uncertainty, an era of turmoil, if you will. We had two energy crises. We had two spurts of inflation. We had serious recession at the end of the decade. So we had economic turmoil in the 70s, and you could make a fortune in the miners. Same thing happened in the 2000s. We had the dot-com bubble pop, and then we had 9/11, and then we had the great financial crisis. So both of those decades, we had economic turmoil. Well, we haven't had economic turmoil. Last decade, there isn't any economic turmoil, and we haven't had any yet this decade. So we're waiting for that.
That's a great point.
I call that the fear trade. So as far as I'm concerned, so far it's just all been noise. The HUI is at 350. The only thing I'm happy about is that the crash hasn't happened yet. And when the crash happens, we're going to be starting from a high level. But as far as I'm concerned, we're not in a bull market yet for stocks because the fear trade hasn't started. So I see we're going to have a crash in the stock market as this bull market ends, 15-year, we go into recession. And when that stock market drops, gold and the miners will go down, but not a lot. My targets are $2,800 gold, plus or minus 100. And then $28 silver, say plus or minus $2. And then HUI at 280, plus or minus 20 points. And we're at 350 right now. So I think that's where we're headed, into those ranges. And then gold will bounce. So gold's going to lead the way here. And then what's going to happen is, so you're going to, the fear trade will start. Gold will be going down. The stock market will be going down. And the fear trade will be igniting, if you will. At a certain point, gold will get a bid. And when it gets a bid, it'll put in a floor. It'll put in a bottom. And that is what we're waiting for. That's the trigger, because everybody is going to realize that gold just bounced off the bottom. The markets are going, that's the decoupling. I've been waiting for this decoupling. The markets are going down, gold's going up. It'll be very obvious. Gold will be up like 30 bucks. It'll go down like, let's say it goes down to what I said, 2,800, somewhere around 2,800. And then suddenly it bounces all the way back to 3,000. And the miners and the stocks are still going down. At that point, everybody, it's clear as day, gold's going to 4,000 and everybody's going to be jumping on it. And that's when the miners will bounce too. So it's all about this decoupling, this bouncing. Now, there's some people, like last night, a guy that TA guy. A lot of the TA guys are very bullish gold here because they like to chart. The guy last night, Grady, I mean, he actually attacked anybody that he was calling as pretty foolish, thinking that gold's going to break down here, that gold is going to 2800. It was kind of an interesting tweet. He basically said that we're not going to retest 3000, which would be fantastic. I hope he's right. I mean, that'd be beautiful. I mean, if we don't retest 3000, we could be at 4000 by the end of the year.
Yeah.
I think we're going to go down to 2800 and then bounce to maybe 3200 to 3400 by the end of the year. But if he's right, if we don't retest 3000, we're going over 3500 this year. We go over 3500 this year, the miners are going to rip. But I still think the miners are going to rip. I do think we're going to go silver go down to 28 plus or minus $2. And then it'll rip all the way to 40, somewhere between 45 and 65 by the end of the year, depending on if we get a shortage. Because I think there's a possibility for a shortage in 1,000-ounce bars. If we get a shortage in 1,000-ounce bars,
we're going to go quick.
You could go from 45 to 65 in a month.
Yeah.
It'll depend on that. But I do think we'll get to at least 45 by the end of the year, which will be a big move in the miners. You're talking about 100-200% move on a lot of these miners. So I'm very bullish the second half of the year, but Q2, I'm bearish. I think that we're going to have a pause here. April and May, we're going to have a pause. So we're at 350 on the HUI. I think we get to the end of May. And we're well below 350 is my expectation. Maybe all the way down 300, 310. Still fighting through this selling pressure on the S&P. But the key to it all for me, what takes gold to 4,000 is a fear trade. And that's what makes these miners. I think the HUI is going to 1,200 to 1,500. We're at 350. So if you're at 300, this thing could easily go up 4X, 5X from that point. So if you're on the sidelines and then you jump in it, so we crash down back below 300 and you're waiting for this final bounce and then we get above 300, I think that's the entry point. We're at 350 today. You wait until this thing crashes all the way down. And then once it turns and starts going back up, I think that's that's the best risk reward point. So if you get in at 300 HUI and this thing goes to 1500, that's a 400% return on Newmont. The HUI is basically the big miners. It's a 400% return on Newmont. So what does that tell you about the mid tiers?
Yeah, they're going to rip.
They will just absolutely go bonkers. And that's over a 2 to 3 year period.
Yeah.
So you brought up something good, and I guess the caveat is obviously we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And I certainly hope gold just rips and silver just takes off, all of that. But to my viewers and listeners, I was talking to Don briefly offline here, and I took some profits off the table just last week, just because things have gone up so fast and so high. And Don, I really share your sentiments, and I'm not looking at the charts like you do, but I just share it just from the sense of, I've been doing this for 30 years, and you get a good rip like we just had. There's always, in my memory, serves me correctly, there's always been a big, significant profit taking and even a washout. So I'm waiting for that. So I really support your thesis here. I don't know exactly at what levels. I'm still about 70% invested here. And if it keeps on going up, I'm going to participate in the upside. But if we get a washout, I'll be, as you've said, Don, and you've taught me, just buy to the bottom, buy some really good, great quality name, just going to the bottom, if you would, to a target area. So.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that the norm is you get a correction of some type. So gold has had in a 12-month run right now. It started its run in February. You can go back further, but if you look at the miners, the HUI was at 200 a year ago. Now we're a little more than a year, March. So we're 12 months out. It was February. So that's when this whole thing started just going absolutely bonkers, if you will. So we haven't had any correction in gold in a year. So the odds are we will have one at some point. Now, as far as the breakout level, when do you get back in? I've been saying this, that the breakout level for me, if you look at the HUI chart, it's clear as day for me that the breakout level is 350, which is where we're at right now. And isn't it interesting? It got to 350 and it's pausing because that's the overhead resistance. And I thought it might get through it, but it'd be a false breakout. We might get to 360, 365. That I thought that was as high as we would get before the washout. Mm-hmm. Once we get to 370, at that point, I think silver will be above 35. So you need to get the breakout, you need three things to all happen. You need gold above 3,000, we're there. You need the HUI above 350, we're there. And you need silver above 35, which hasn't happened. And the reason why you need it above 35 is technical chart on silver. That's overhead resistance. You got to get above the resistance. Same with 350. That's the resistance. You got to get above those resistance levels and then you start ripping higher. So we get above 35. I like to see above 36 for like a month. You get above 36 for a month, and I think you're going to 45 and within 3 or 6 months. Yeah. There's not a lot of overhead resistance. We've only been above 36 twice. In 1980 and 2011, twice. That's it. Those are the only, we're talking a month or two above 36. It's happened twice. So we get 36 again. The chances are there's no overhead resistance. You're going to rip to 45. And then it's going to decide, we're going to make a little correction here. We're going to rip through 49. I think you can be patient here, but what if silver does get above 35? That time you got to get ready. It's like, okay, gold. If that happens, that means that gold isn't going to retest 3,000. Yeah. And Grady's right. We're not retesting 3,000. We're just ripping to 3,500. So if you see silver get above 35, that's when you jump in. You're like, I'm going to miss this train. I've always said that. If you are on the sideline, the train leaves the station at those three levels, 3,000, 350, 35. So you get above those three levels, you want to jump on that plane before it leaves the station. Mm-hmm. Leaving the station, you're going to have about a 1 month period. That's it. 1 month. You got 1 month to jump on board.
Yeah.
Because after that 1 month, you're going to be at 380, 390, 400 HUI. You're going to miss a lot of this upside. You'll see stocks like Coeur and Hecla be up 50% in a month.
Yeah. And I've seen it before too.
Let's talk about that. If you don't mind, can we talk about some specific names? We'll start with some majors and maybe work our down a little bit. And maybe that'll give our listeners just a few things to chew on, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, we have some time here. I want to actually, before we talk about any stocks, I want to talk a little bit about, I talked about earlier about a recession coming and I talked about negative fallout and I threw a few data points out there. Why?
Yeah.
So I just want people to realize that the economy is kind of on fire right now and everybody's kind of in denial. And the reason why they're in denial is because there's been so much liquidity thrown into this system that it's given us a false sense of strength. Mm-hmm. The stock market being high, a lot of money flooded in. So it is basically keeping things, we have a semblance of normalcy, if you will, and it's misleading. So when things do turn south, it's like, okay, this doesn't surprise me so much, but we've had this normalcy bias for 15 years. And I want to point out some of this weakness. I'm going to start with the banks. So the banks, their balance sheets are basically turds because they have all these bonds that they bought at zero interest rates that are underwater. So the way bonds work, when you buy bonds, they have their valuation changes. You get paid interest, but if you want to sell those bonds, you want to mark the market, they get valued based on interest rates. Mm-hmm. So if you buy them at zero interest rates and they go to five you lose the valuation of that asset just goes in the toilet. Yep. That happened to all the banks. So the banks have these lousy balance sheets and they're basically ignoring them. But it's there. It's real. And those balance sheets aren't going to clean up overnight. So you got that. Then their commercial real estate is a total mess because they own all this commercial real estate that's crashed in value. So that's on their books and that's holding them back. Then on top of that, you have delinquencies in credit cards, delinquencies in autos. As far as banks are concerned, we're in a severe recession. So you got that going on. Well, the banks are kind of the heart of local economies. They're in like no mood to loan money. And as soon as a recession sniffs out, that it gets even harsher. So you know, I'm just telling you, the banks are in bad shape right now. We're heading into recession. Then if you look at the consumer, the average consumer, average, if you will, can't pay their bills. Average. 50% can't pay their bills. All they're doing each month is they're deciding. They look at their budget and they look at what they used to spend it on. And they look at it and they go, okay, what can we spend it on this month? They literally have to decide what to include, what to exclude. That's the norm today. And so the average consumer's discretionary income has collapsed. And if you look at retail sales for last year, it was flat. And so consumer spending, retail sales is a big chunk of the economy, and that's under pressure. And it's not improving because people are trying to catch up, but they're not getting big wage increases. Okay, then the auto and housing industries are two of our biggest industries. New loan applications right now is lower than it was back when things were in 2007-08, when things were were awful. They're worse today now than it was then. Housing's a mess right now. If you're a real estate agent, yeah, it's no fun. It's basically in a recession. Then if you look at autos, the auto industry, Trump wants to, you know, they're starting to get a little bit, you know, Trump's going to help them out in tariffs or whatever. But if you're an auto salesman right now, it's not fun to go to work. It's basically a recession. And if they look at their income and they look, you know, and they look at what they're getting paid on a monthly basis. So there are no green shoots in the economy right now, other than things that are possibly coming because of these tariffs will bring in a lot of investment money in. But that's all down the road. That's not going to help us in the next 6 months, in the next 3 months, if we do go into recession. If we do go into recession, all of these things are going to add to it. The final point I want to make about the underlying economy that is going to kind of rug pull us when things are going to get worse quickly is the fact that the government revenues are dependent in a lot of ways on capital gains. And if the stock market crashes, the monthly revenue for the U.S. is going to drop. And all this Doge money that they're saving is like it's going to be nothing. It's going to basically get wiped out. Doge is like, yeah, we saved $200 billion, but capital gains is decreased by $100 billion. It's like, and so I mentioned it earlier, it's like we're heading into a train wreck and there's nothing really that can prevent it from happening.
Yeah, I was looking at like new car sales, the auto industry, how much they're hurting. And then just this morning, actually, I was looking at that. It was this morning. And then I was also thinking, too, how do banks make any money in this environment, right? They don't. So that's
right. The investment banks have been making a fortune on Wall Street. But now if the stock market crashes, those investment banks should be having trouble, too. But you're right. The regional banks are not making money.
So that's just the liquidity issue there.
We're going to see the worst banking crisis since the 30s. We're going to see it's going to be ugly, ugly, ugly.
Do you think they'll bail out?
They won't be able to. They literally will not be able to print that much money. So they're going to do bail-ins.
Yeah.
Basically not going to cover if you're, they probably will cover the insurance up to $250,000, but if you're above it, they're not going to bail you out. They're basically going to say, nope, sorry, we're only going to cover this much. And I wouldn't be surprised if we actually hit a wall with the insurance where you actually do get bailed in. It's going to be nasty.
Probably. Well, on that note, let's talk some gold and silver stocks here. I have this theory, and this is just me, how I build my portfolio. I start with the strongest names, if you would, the Newmonts of the world, the Mag Silvers of the world, and then I work my way down into mid-cap, or I should say mid-producers or small producers, if you would. And then I go to the explorers. And explorers, I have in two different categories. One that they're out there exploring. They don't know what they have, but I like the area, what they have. And the other ones, I like what they have in the ground. And I'm a little more picky what we, the explorers, what we think what we have in the ground. And they just drill a little bit more. Work me through that specifically. How should people be positioning themselves, or how would you position it? Starting with some of the big stocks. I do like Newmont. I do like Hecla, two companies that you mentioned. I do like Mag Silver. I like them probably more than I like First Majestic, but I own all of those four companies. Just give us a starting point. How should you start?
So I like producers the most, as from a risk reward standpoint. I can find five baggers all over the place. The majors, I mean, if we look at the two biggest, Agnico Eagle and Alamos and Lundin, those three are probably the elite producers. Those stocks are all two to three baggers. I mean, so kind of the worst at $4,000 gold, those are kind of the worst return you're going to get.
Let me interrupt you. Just, it's kind of ironic. The best run companies and the 1,000-pound gorillas are going to be the worst performers, which I agree with you, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but you're going to get two to three baggers, which isn't bad at all. And then Newmont and Barrick, you're going to get three to potentially four baggers. So you just go up the food chain just a little bit, and you're already there. And then go to the strong silver names, and you're five plus baggers really quickly. SSR Mining, B2 Gold, Aris Mining, Dundee. You know, you're up to five plus baggers really quick. And then if you go to the silver miners, you're over five baggers. You're at five to 10 baggers. Hecla and Coeur and Endeavor and First Majestic, Fresnillo, you're five to 10. So when you can find quality producers at those levels, that's where I want to own as many as those I can get my hands on. I want to be overweight those guys because those have the best risk reward. I also like to own location wise. I want to I own a lot of Aussie mid-tier producers.
Sure.
And if I can find any mid-tier producer in Canada, which is becoming more difficult because they just seem to get eaten up once they go into production. Because the majors love to own those mines. Like Skeena's getting ready to go into production, they'll probably get eaten up as soon as they get into production. It's just hard.
I think so.
Yeah, it's hard for these companies in Canada, but there's a lot of mid tiers in Australia, and so I own about 10 of them. And Gold Fields tried to take out Gold Road, and Gold Road said no. They tried to pay a 28% premium, which I thought was ridiculously low. I mean, Gold Road could double this year alone. And they want it, so they're basically stealing it for 28%. But they told them no. But we're going to see a lot of consolidation in Australia, I think. And so I want to own as many as I can because I want to own the buyer. I don't want to own the seller. And if I own them both, that's even better. But I especially want to own the buyer because I want to own the sharks.
Yeah,
that's kind of where I would start. You mentioned Mag Silver earlier. Now, Mag is one of those ones, it's more of a royalty play. I think Mag, Wheaton are basically the same thing. They're both three to four baggers. They're just generating free cash, paying dividends. I don't own any. I do own Mag, but I plan to sell it at $50, $60 silver because they have no growth. I don't really like their pipeline. I consider them a royalty play. I actually tweeted out today that they're basically just a royalty play, playing dividends on Juan Cepeda, excuse me. But I mean, it's kind of a low risk. I mean, it kind of fits in there with Barrick and Newmont, but it's lower risk than those stocks because I don't see Juan Cepeda stopping production. They haven't had any problems there. They haven't had any labor problems there. So, but it's a single mine. I mean, there's always a possibility if Juan Cepeda shuts down, your Mac could literally crash 20-0 overnight. I don't really like single mines for that reason. I mean, Victoria Gold went bankrupt because they only had one mine. If they would have diversified in a second mine, they might have survived that. SNF Star Mining had their problem in Turkey, but they survived because they had other mines. So single mine companies, they add risk. So we have that. Okay, now developers. I like developers that check all the boxes. And you can go, I did it's online. I did one at Brick. I did it talking about how to analyze stocks. And I talk about my check boxes. You guys could find that. How I analyze these development stories. And if they don't check all the boxes, then I'm more apprehensive of buying them. I might gamble on. But you can find these developers that do check all the boxes. One that I really liked, it's coming in production right now, is West Red Lake Gold. It's actually now a near-term producer. They actually come online. They're going to ramp up in June, July. So that one is a more of a near-term. A little longer-term was Go Gold. They're a little bit further out. They're Los Ricos project. I think that one checks all the boxes. Discovery, but they just bought a gold producer, so they're going to be a gold producer. But their development project, their silver project down in Mexico, is exciting for me. Sonora, they're just waiting for their permit. That's another one that checks for me. Checks all the boxes. For checking all the boxes, I want to have a company that's very highly undervalued. I like at least to have a 10 bagger. Then I want a strong project, economic project that I know is going to generate free cash flow, has a long life. And then I want a management team that can build a mine. And then I want insiders. I want a management team that not only can build a mine, but tells me they want to build a mine, they're going to build a mine, and then they have the insiders to make it happen. So if somebody calls them and says, yeah, we'll pay you 100% premium, they say, no, we don't want it. So you got to, for me, you got to be really picky on development plays, because they tend to break your heart. There's so many things that can go wrong. I mean, because they have such upside. And the biggest thing that breaks your heart is they get bought out. And so the person who buys the company, I mentioned earlier, I want to own the buyer. The company that buys the company, they get all the upside. Sometimes they get cash buyouts and you just totally get screwed. I remember Del Radian was a beautiful development project in Ireland. And they baited a cash buyout. They basically just stole your shares. They said, here, give me a 35% premium. Here's your shares back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So cash buyouts are absolutely the worst. And then the other thing goes wrong is the ramp up. They can have overruns. They go to build a mine and it costs more than you expect. And that kind of rug pulls your upside. And then they do the ramp up. They don't hit their grades. They don't hit their cost. I mean, Ascot has been a bit of a nightmare trying to get that mine up and running. And so there's that. And then developers, I do like to have a nice chunk of developers because they can turn into producers. And that's ideally what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to buy a mid-tier producer cheap. When I buy a developer, that's what my objective is. I'm trying to buy a mid-tier producer cheap. And I'm hoping, and that's how you can get a 25 bagger. Mm-hmm. But it's basically, it starts out as a 5 to 10, but if the company grows, you can get a 20-25 bagger that way. And then last one that I like in my bucket is optionality plays. The bad thing about optionality plays is they're not generally a 10 bagger. They're generally just a 3 to 8 bagger. But it's easy money because all you have to do is wait to get paid. Eventually it's going higher. And so you have like Southern Silver. They're trading at 25 cents an ounce in the ground. You know, I don't see them selling for less than a dollar. So we just sit there and wait. I mean, we could get rug pulled and they only sell for, you know, 50 cents, 75 cents in the ground. but we're going to make money, but it's a matter of how much. I mean, they're just super cheap. They're not going to sell. Then you have Free Gold Ventures selling at today at $10 an ounce. But if gold prices keep going up, their cutoff grade goes down. And now suddenly you have 40 million and you're paying $8 an ounce in the ground. So it's all about cutoff for Free Gold. But Free Gold has like 50% plus insiders who are not selling. They're private investors. So Free Gold, their board can't, if somebody calls and says, yeah, we want to buy you, it's like, hey, sure, but you got to, these private investors, you got to get them to vote yes. You know, we'd love to sell. Yeah, we'll sell to you tomorrow for 100% premium, but these guys aren't. So I love Free Gold for that reason. They're just not going to sell cheap. So it's like, it's easy money. Banyan right now is like $6-$8 in the ground. That's four that, you know, these optionality plays. Then Lahontan, I bought Lahontan at 2 cents. Now it's up to almost 4 cents. I mean, it's like, it was trading at $4 an ounce in the ground in Nevada for 2 million ounce property. It's like insane valuations. We've seen these insane valuations. Getchell's another one. It's in Nevada. It's about 25 million, but it's trading cheap. I mean, so I like optionality plays. I don't really like to chase early drill stories. The risk reward just isn't there. The only time you really want to get an early drill story is if you get in early on a discovery hole, and I have a YouTube video on identifying a good discovery hole. You get in early on a discovery hole and then you put some money in and then you hope they have a follow-up hole. They have one, they have two, they have three. You can get a 5 to 10 bagger fairly quickly. Yeah. But you need to make sure you get in early. You don't want to chase these stocks that are already valued at, you know, 200 million plus and they're trying to, you know, grow, because the upside, the risk reward just isn't there. And so I actually think that the one thing about these early drill stories is you tend to have to get out. I mean, once, like Snowline, I mean, once it got to, you know, 800 billion at that point, you got in early at 80 million and you got a 10 bagger, you got to get out. It's like, yes. I can't, why am I just sitting? You're just sitting around waiting for it to double.
Yeah.
When you could have five baggers all over the place in other places. So you have to get out. Like I've gotten out, like I got out of Oh My Gold. I got out of Collective. You get in early and once it rips, you got to get out, because the rest of the upside, you know, you can't really guarantee it's going to be there. It's gotten pricey. You know, it's not an optionality play anymore. And so, yeah, so be careful on drill stories. Read my book. My book, How to Invest in Gold and Silver, really explains all this stuff, really explains how to analyze risk on each of the levels. It does talk about developers on these check boxes, and it talks about producers, how to value them, how to understand what the upside is going to be, how valuable they are. So the book is very useful.
Well, two questions really quick, and then we got to go. But really, first question, you mentioned royalties. Doesn't seem like you're a big fan of royalties. Is this because of the upside is relatively capped in a ripping market? That'd be my first question. And then the second question that I have is there a jurisdiction that you won't touch?
Yeah. I'll start with royalty and I'll do the jurisdiction. Well, jurisdiction's easier. Yeah, there's lots of them I won't touch. Yeah, you got to be careful on location risk. Like South Africa, I've been burned there, so I stay away. DRC, like there's been in the news lately, I've stayed away from that. A lot of people are like, I don't have a problem with DRC. Me, so I've kind of stayed away from Central Africa, South Africa, Eastern Africa. Those areas are kind of no-goes for me. I just stick with West. And then Central and South America. Of course, Venezuela is a no-go, but that's really the only one. Ecuador and Bolivia. Ecuador, it's getting a little better. Bolivia's getting better. I don't have really a problem. Those have been two kind of problem childs, but they've been all right. Argentina is improving a lot lately. And I think Argentina improving, I think that also helps like Chile. It helps them, I think, be more mining friendly. Chile was kind of a gray area, but I think they're getting better. So on the whole, Colombia has been kind of hit and miss, but I don't have a problem there. But Russian satellite countries, I stay away from those. Those are no-goes. I've had bad luck in Eastern Europe. I've had bad luck in the Philippines, Indonesia. Those are kind of risky areas for me. I'm okay. I do have Papua New Guinea. I'm all right with a K92. Fiji, I think, is a mining friendly. I kind of get more excited about mining friendly. I'm okay with Guyana. West Africa, I know I'm going to get burned. I just know I am because I'm overweight West Africa. I own too many because the reason I like West Africa is the free cash flow. But you get burned because you don't get the high multiples. Spain, I've had bad luck there, but it's hit and miss. I'm okay with Spain on the whole. I love Australia. Okay, New Zealand's the same. I like New Zealand. I love Australia and Canada. I'm okay with Canada. U.S., I've had bad luck in California, but Apollo's in San Bernardino. I don't own it. I'm thinking about maybe buying it. No, there isn't really any places in the U.S., but Washington State is kind of a no-go for me. I don't trust Washington State. Eastern Oregon's okay. Montana's been having trouble. I don't know what's up with Montana. I think Utah, Arizona are okay. Nevada's okay. And so on the whole, U.S. is all right. I think I covered most of them. Now, let's go to the royalty model. I don't do royalty models because two reasons. One, the companies don't have control over their growth. They don't have control over their mines. I don't like that. They just buy. They everything's based on a contract. And my feeling at the very beginning was, I'm this guy that's really is a big believer in high silver and gold prices, especially silver. Like, I think silver's going to 100. Gary Savage likes to say, you know, it's easy, and I agree with him. I think $100 silver is easy. So if we go to $100 silver, the contracts break. They break. They're too one-sided. I mean, all I have to do is do the revenue. So if you go to $100 silver, a lot of these contracts for the life of the mine are $4 an ounce. In other words, you sell it for $4 and it costs you $10. So you're losing. Here's the math. If you have a $4 contract, you're losing, and your cash costs are $10. You're losing $6 an ounce in every ounce that you're giving to this company. And the other company is getting, you ready for this? $96 an ounce in profit.
Yeah.
They're getting 96 and you're losing six. Are you gonna give them your silver? No chance in hell you're giving it to them. You're basically saying, we're redoing the contract. At that point, the model breaks. Because once you start getting companies that are redoing the contracts, then no contract, the contracts don't mean anything. So the point is this. If the model's going to break at 100, because I guarantee you it's breaking at 100. If it's breaking at 100, does it break at 80? Does it break at 70? Does it break at 60? We don't know where it breaks. All we know is it's going to break.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to a few CEOs in the royalty space, and they agree with me. They're like, one guy, he literally told me it's already breaking. We're already seeing what you're saying, Don, is already happening. People are already redoing contracts. It's just kind of under the covers. And so when I look at that model, I'm going, the model's going to break eventually. And I'm a long-term investor. So I'm a long-term investor, and I believe the model's going to break. So why do I own Wheaton? Now, Wheaton, man, it's a thing of beauty. I mean, their margins are just unbelievable. I mean, they have no debt. They got $800 million in cash, and they're just cash is just rolling in.
Yeah.
They're throwing out dividends. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you're going to get rug pulled, I think. You know, they'll announce that, you know, they're going to redo a contract, and then what's going to happen is their multiples are going to squeeze. So Wheaton's multiple right now is about 30, 35, and it'll squeeze down to 20, 25. And then once that happens, the whole industry will squeeze, the margins will start squeezing down. They won't be able to get those 30, 35% free cash flow multiples.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I don't own them. And then the other one is I think I can get better returns through producers. So I think about the royalty play as a very low risk producer, but I can get better returns on a producer. And plus a producer can grow, I think, faster. Yeah. So, but I do like Wheaton. I think Wheaton is a really strong royalty name out there. It's really the only one I kind of have FOMO for. I used to like Sandstorm a lot, but they've had trouble the last few years. I think they're turning a corner. And then Triple Flag, I think, is doing well. And then the new one, Gold. The other one I kind of have FOMO for is Gold Royalty. The guy, the CEO of Gold Royalty, he's a rock star in the business. And he actually started as a CEO in regular mines. And now he's gone over to royalty place. Most of these royalty companies, they're like newbies, you know, guys that just, we're just going to do the royalty model. But he's got experience across the board, a lot of it. And so I think those three are all going to do well. Triple Flag, Gold Royalty, and Wheaton. I think those stocks are all going to do really well, and people are going to be very happy.
Yeah. I think with Triple Flag, Triple Flag was down in Atlanta about 3 weeks ago, and I met with them. I mean, how do you evaluate a company over a lunch? But they seem like very sharp, and I do like the model. And it's a New York Stock Exchange listing, so they have a very strong listing. It's either New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, so they have a really strong listing. So, but Don, I've taken way too much of your time. For the record, everybody, I am an investor in West Red Lake as well as Sonora Gold. Don and I did not mention any stocks before this video. I just asked him, and he was gracious enough to share with us. Don, you need no exit or introduction, but I'd love to tell the audience anyways, how can people find you? Again, you are a rock star in your own right, as well as how do they read your book? How do they get access to that? And I'll put all of this in the show notes.
So my website is for people that already own gold and silver mining stocks. It's a tool for you to improve your portfolio. It's not a stock picking service, but definitely will help you improve your portfolio with the data, because I give you lots of stocks to go take a look at. And then my book, How to Invest in Gold and Silver. I mentioned that one earlier. And then you can follow me. I'm on Twitter. I have a community there that we're over 1,000 people. So we basically share information, which is good. And then you can follow me on Substack for free. I post on Substack as well, Don Durrett. Thanks, Andy.
Hey, thank you. I'll put all of this in the show notes. It's always a pleasure to see you. And great to see you, Don.
All right, Andy.